This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, will a political firestorm at the Justice Department affect the White House and more backlash after the firing of 8 U.S. attorneys? Joining us on the panel are E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism at Hofstra University School of Communication, John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute senior fellow in public policy, and Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle. So, guys, let's start with the dismissal of 8 U.S. attorneys. It's created a political firestorm. And after pressure from the Democrats, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez admitted the White House mishandled the firings. He's been at the center of the saga. He canceled a trip Tuesday to field questions about the dismissals, and he said he wants to ensure the same mistakes don't happen again.
I've overcome a lot of obstacles in my life to become Attorney General. I am here not because I give up. I am here because I've learned from my mistakes, because I accept responsibility, and because I'm committed to doing my job.
Now, this morning on ABC's Good Morning America, Senator Hillary Clinton said that President Bush, quote, needs to be very forthcoming. What did he say? What did he know? What did he do? And that high-level White House advisor Karl Rove also owes the Congress and the country an explanation for his role in the affair. So, John, I'll start with you. Is this going to reach the White House? It's already reached the AG. Is it going to reach the White House?
Well, you know, we can never know, but I wouldn't be surprised if the story plays out a little differently in this case, because there's a certain effort by this administration to be Teflon, so to speak, and there's the idea that one never caves, one never admits mistakes, but certain things are beginning to come a little too closely together, and given that we have just seen what happened with the Scooter Libby trial, where there's a high suspicion that some rather unsavory doings go a little bit further than the person who was actually punished. It might be that in this case, not only will Gonzalez be required to do something other than say, I'm sorry, mistake for me, but I'm not budging. But it could be that things go further, because it seems that it would be difficult to say that there was no intent behind this and that these things were just accidents or business as usual. And people are getting fed up, and there's no longer a rubber stamp Congress for these people. So I wouldn't be surprised if this time the story went differently.
Jeff, last week Congress called for the Attorney General's resignation. Is this going to have any effect?
Yeah, I think it probably will. It seems to be popular now to not only criticize the administration that's in place, but to take the recent elections as a kind of mandate from the public to do everything from, blocking the war, to blocking the buildup in Iraq, to eliminating our presence in Iraq, to fixing whatever the system means. We put the system in quotations. And in this case, it's the firing of these U.S. attorneys. It's not that this has not happened before. I think it was in 93 when President Clinton fired a significant number, I think almost all of them except for one, of the attorneys. But I think that because Gonzalez back in January affirmed that politics didn't have anything to do with this particular issue, and now we see that in cases like in New Mexico, where that attorney general was criticized for not prosecuting Democrats for election fraud, politics might have creeped into it. And I think that this is an issue that the Democrats are going to seize as an inroads to continue the assault on the current administration.
Now, ER, want to shift directions a little bit. In John's statement, he mentioned that times have changed. Things seem to be shifting in terms of how people either in the media or in government view the invincibility so far of the Bush administration to really have to make serious changes. Do you think that the media has come to the party late and has begun to really look into aspects of the presidency that it should have looked into far before?
Oh, definitely. Most definitely. And we've seen that in several different areas now, where it takes the unveiling of scandal by someone. Think about the Washington Post talking about some issues that the press should have raised a long time ago in looking at the VA hospital disaster. But on this one, let me step back to something that was said. This has already reached the White House. Harriet Myers, remember, was the White House counsel, and she was very much involved in the decisions to eliminate some of these U.S. attorneys. In fact, she's proposed getting rid of everybody at the beginning of the second term. She was in contact with Mr. Gonzalez's good friend and chief of staff, who resigned the other day. So it's already at the White House level, and now the White House is telling the press that it doesn't really, well, they're sort of off the record telling the press that they don't have any faith in Gonzalez. So guess who's going to be the next one to fall? If you see the picture in the New York Times today, or if you saw his press conference yesterday, you saw a guy standing alone at a microphone. And that's probably a symbol of what's going on there. They're hanging him out to dry.
And you mentioned Harriet Myers, who, of course, the president put up for Supreme Court nomination.
She was his counsel.
Exactly.
Yes. She was his counsel and good friend and flunky and totally unqualified to be a U.S. Supreme Court justice and ultimately resigned. But it was she who initiated, apparently, some of this back and forth between the White House and the Justice Department.
And John, Senator Clinton can say as much as she wants that Karl Rove owes the Congress and the country an explanation and that the president needs to be forthcoming, but those two gentlemen have never been particularly responsive to that kind of a call.
No, they have not, and that seems to be a matter of style. You can imagine them crowing about it as they write about their performance in later years. And the question is whether or not events can make it so that that won't go anymore. There seems to be a certain weight of truly embarrassing episodes showing the nastiness behind a lot of what these people do that might be such that this one is the tipping point. As ER says, Gonzalez is not getting the kind of chummy support that these people usually get. Rove kind of slipped out of the noose already on the Patrick Fitzgerald investigation. Will he be able to do it again? And it's a different Congress, and so it seems that there might actually be some teeth in the usual comments from left of center that people need to be called to account. Maybe at this point the culture is such that it could actually be done.
But Republicans are also calling for this, too, so that's the interesting thing.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's move along to another topic. But before we do, in case you're just tuning in, this is NPR's News and Notes. I am Farai Chidea. This is our roundtable, and we have got E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism at Hofstra University School of Communication, John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute senior fellow in public policy, and Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle. Jeff, I'm going to start this one with you. Crack cocaine. Congress might be willing to take a look at the ways to ease crack cocaine sentencing guidelines. The American Civil Liberties Union and other critics say that the current laws have filled prisons with low-level dealers and addicts. Federal prison sentences for possessing or selling crack are far worse than for powder cocaine. And the House Crime Subcommittee Chairman Robert Scott has spoken out against the sentencing policies, and he plans to hold hearings on crack sentences this year. Now, this is an issue that people like Congresswoman Maxine Waters have brought up again and again. Is this something whose time has come?
I definitely think so. I appreciate you starting the crack cocaine with me. I'll take that as a compliment there. But if I'm going to start this crack conversation.
Jeff Obafemi Carr, more addictive than crack cocaine.
There you go. Okay, I like it. I love it. I'm glad this is now being seriously looked at by the lawmakers. Sentencing definitely needs to be and has needed to be for years more fair and equitable across the board. There is absolutely no chemical difference between the drugs once they're in the bloodstream if we're targeting users. And as far as targeting dealers, which has been the focus of a lot of people in law enforcement and a lot of people in the prison industry and wanting to lock people up, this you have to look at who supports this kind of divide. And it's usually the prison industry, the growing prison industry from law enforcement to prosecution.
But
it's
Jeff,
much easier to get to ride up on a guy on the street corner and bust a young cat with a few rocks in his pocket than it is to find a private party in a suburban mansion where the powder is piled up on trays. So I think that by equalizing the sentencing there, I think there will be a little more fairness applied across the board, and it's something that should have come up.
But, Jeff, let me tell you a little story. I was in Oakland at a you know, town meeting, and this there was a big discussion about three strikes, and this woman, a very, you know, put together working class mom, got up and said, "You know what? I'm happy that there's three strikes. I know it disproportionately falls on black kids, but I can't have my kids out there with the dealers." So what do you say to that?
I say that that's one person's opinion. But I think that if you talk to people across the board, I think that by and large, a majority of people, especially when you're talking about African-Americans who live in the inner city, whose kids feel disenfranchised and feel that they have to turn to the corners. I'm not making an excuse for them because I had some times coming up where it was rough and I didn't make that choice to turn to the corners. But to people who feel as if they're caught in a three strikes law or in a net that will turn them into a permanent underclass, then they are, by and large, by the majority, going to disagree with that sentiment.
John, what about that whole tension between the idea that African Americans are disproportionately affected by these laws, but at the same time, black communities are disproportionately affected by the crime?
Well, you know, what these disparities come down to is a very simple thing. There really needs to be written a book called The New Black History. And whatever you think about these disparities, there is a guiding notion in a lot of people's minds that if you could roll the tape back to 1986, what happened is that a bunch of overweight, suburban, barbecuing, middle-aged white people cooked up some laws to get as many black men into prison as possible by making crack cocaine more prosecutable than powdered cocaine. And that is simply a myth. If you did roll the tape back, what you would see is people of the Maxine Waters type, concerned black people, who were every bit as much behind that legislation, and in some cases more than the white people, many of whom really didn't care. The idea was exactly as you say, to help black communities where this particular kind of cocaine was a serious problem. Now, nobody expected the result to be precisely what it is today, but the institution of those laws had nothing to do with racism. It was instituted by people who might as well be our mothers and our fathers. So we can fix it now, because you can't always know what's going to happen in the future. But all of the college term papers and books and comments that people make at conferences and things you find on blog sites about the idea that crack being something that you get in more trouble for than powder is because people don't like the black guy and they don't mind the white executive sniffing cocaine at his desk is a complete myth. It's an oversimplification of history. So the past is not...
Let's let ER get in.
I was going to say we're overlooking one aspect of what was going on when these laws were changed, and that is the amount of violence that was out there that was connected to crack cocaine. It was scaring the heck out of everybody, not just the suburbanites barbecuing that John described. It was scaring people in the neighborhoods, black people. It was frightening the grandmothers of the very young people who were out there dealing with crack. Crack was whack. So that was, I guess...
I believe that is a direct Whitney Houston quote. But anyway,
something like that. But anyway, it was... But it was a time when people were very, very afraid. And out of that panic came these laws. Now we have a better opportunity to assess what has happened, the unintended consequences, and all of that. And perhaps something will change for the better.
There's something to point out, though, on something ER just said. She said there was a time when people were afraid and they accepted these laws. I'm summarizing, but now we have a chance to look back. And this goes into building a bridge between what John said and what ER is saying. I think I'm not saying that it's totally a myth that this was cooked up as a conspiracy against black men. I'm not going to say that's totally a myth, because I can't prove that it's not true, that was to some extent considered in the making of these laws. But what I will say is, it's like the Patriot Act. It's after 9/11. People were afraid, so they said, okay, here, just do whatever it takes to secure the nation. So years later, out of that fear, we're looking back and saying, man, I gave up a lot of my freedom. People are tapping the telephones. People are listening to conversations. They're locking me down in the airports. Now we have an opportunity to look back and say, oh my gosh, this was a knee-jerk reaction. So those who wanted this kind of state the whole time seized upon that moment when fear was present more than any other time before. It's the same thing with this crack thing. There was a time when we were seeing images of people with AK-47s running in the street. So now the lawmakers said, and corporate America said, hey, look, here's an opportunity for us to just kind of wipe all of that out. And because of a state of fear, we said, sure, whatever it takes. And now we're looking back and seeing that it has disproportionately affected our young men. And we have to make a fix in that situation.
Now, ER, you said we can fix this. We can fix the laws if you think that they're broken. But how can you fix if there have been too many people, regardless of race, sent to jail for long sentences for crimes that may not have warranted them? How can you fix that? How can you fix people's ability to get jobs? How can you fix people's ability to lead their lives and build a future?
Well, in many cases, the people who are probably in prison because of drug convictions didn't have much of a future in the first place because of lack of education. So they're going to have trouble no matter what. What can happen is that perhaps there can be some early releases of those who have tried to turn their lives around while in prison and taken advantage of educational opportunities and other things. But in the community at large, we, big we, have to try to make it very unfashionable to get involved in this drug culture in the first place and try to offer some alternatives to whatever it is that's attracting young people to drugs.
All right, we're going to have to stop right now. E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism, Hofstra University School of Communication. She was in our New York bureau. John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute senior fellow in public policy, was in New Jersey. And Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle, was in Nashville, Tennessee at Spotland Productions. Thank you all.
Thank you.
And as always, if you'd like to comment on any of the topics you've heard on the roundtable, you can just give us a call at 202-408-3330. That's 202-408-3330, or you can send an email. Just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us, and please be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name. Meanwhile, next on News and Notes, one woman says race does matter in how we view Anna Nicole Smith's death, plus the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame opens its doors to hip-hop.